Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Merrick Garland or Janet Yellen? Merrick Garland, Janet Yellen. Janet Yellen, Merrick Garland. Yeah, no, we're going with Janet Yellen every single time. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Wednesday, the 16th of March. Great as always to have you along, everybody. No disrespect intended to a Supreme Court nominee, but come on. There was Fed news today. The Federal Open Market Committee wrapped up a two-day meeting on interest rates this afternoon. Chair Janet Yellen did a press conference afterward. No increase in rates. That's not a surprise at all. Economic growth here, Janet Yellen said, is moderate. That's a good thing. Job growth is strong. Also good. But then Dr. Yellen got to the rest of the world, which is really the thing that's got a lot of people worried. Here's that bit of tape annotated, I guess you'd say.
Since the turn of the year, concerns about global economic prospects...
Hang on, she's getting there.
...have led to increased financial market volatility...
Yeah.
...and somewhat tighter financial conditions in the United States.
Bonds and loans.
Although financial conditions have improved notably more recently.
Okay.
In addition, economic growth abroad appears to be running at a somewhat softer pace than previously expected.
Again, yeah.
These unanticipated developments, however,
go on,
have not resulted in material changes to the committee's baseline outlook.
So, translation to the annotation, we're fine. Interest rates are going to stay low for a while yet. Two increases maybe this year, April 26th and 27th. of the month. Mark your calendars. Markets took a little while to decide what they thought about the Fed news, and then they decided they liked it. But let's us take a minute here to talk not trades, but the platforms where those trades happen. Today, two of Europe's biggest stock exchanges, the London Stock Exchange Group and Germany's Deutsche Börse, agreed to merge into Europe's biggest exchange group. And back here, the company that owns the New York Stock Exchange is thinking acquisitions as well. But all of that consolidation aside, there are still lots of exchanges, albeit smaller ones, that companies can choose from when listing their shares. So how do they decide? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports picking an exchange is not what it used to be.
In the U.S., there are about 30 stock exchanges of different kinds, the main ones being the NASDAQ and the NYSE. How to pick which one to list on?
In the old days, people would look at differences in trading costs, and each market would argue that their market mechanism was better than the other.
James Angel teaches finance at Georgetown's McDonough School.
But now markets are mainly electronic, and their market mechanisms are so similar, you need an electron microscope to see any difference in market quality.
On top of that, even if you register with one place, your shares can usually still be traded somewhere else.
So you make the decision on softer areas.
Softer areas like which exchange gives you the most freebies?
Many exchanges provide services to their issuers.
Larry Harris teaches at the USC Marshall School of Business.
For example, they'll often provide assistance with corporate governance issues.
Sometimes companies have really soft reasons.
It used to be that NASDAQ used four-letter tickers and the New York Stock Exchange only used three-letter tickers.
Robert Whitelaw teaches finance at NYU's Stern School.
And you're like, what? But it's true, because if you wanted to spell out a word with your ticker symbol, it's easier with four letters than three.
Whitelaw says the stock exchange you list on does matter if you're comparing internationally. Companies tend to list in the country where their shareholders live, for one thing, and listing in the U.S. requires meeting high standards. It's like a quality seal of approval. Other than that, though, it's more and more a global market, and it matters less and less where you list. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Today in social media, changes, they are coming to Instagram, all 400 million users of it. Instead of, you know, the logical thing, showing you pictures in chronological order, it's now going to order your feed based on what its algorithm thinks you are going to find most interesting. Nobody ought to be surprised because Instagram is owned by Facebook, which has pretty much mastered the curation of users' feeds based on what it thinks they, that is we, are going to like. Because as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, it is really not all about we, the users.
People post more than 80 million photos on Instagram every day, and the company says that's just too much for mere humans to manage. Users, on average, are missing 70% of their feeds. But the new algorithm isn't just there to make sure you don't miss out.
Of course, all of this is to appeal to advertisers.
Susan Ettlinger is an analyst with Altimeter Group.
They want to see that they can reach different audiences. They want to understand their likes and preferences. And once you start applying an algorithm to that, you arguably get a better view.
Instagram only started allowing ads a couple years ago. Revenue is expected to reach close to $3 billion next year. But like most changes in social media, this one was met with some dismay from users like freelance writer Delia Cabe in Boston.
I don't want it to become an echo chamber. You know, it would be like if I went to the library and the librarian said, you can only look at the books that I think you will like.
Plus, algorithms can get things wrong. Cabe says other social media sites have assumed she's Irish, has kids, and owes money on student loans. All false. Instagram isn't removing any posts from people's feeds. It's just reordering them.
Initially, it may be a little disruptive, but it's not something that consumers won't get over.
Erna Alfred-Liusis, an analyst with Forrester Research, says they pretty much always do. And she says users can influence what they see.
Like something. Share something, comment.
And when you do, you'll make it even easier for Instagram to serve you up to advertisers for the sell. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
You can hit us up on Instagram. Marketplace APM is the show. Kai Rizdahl is me. I'm the same on Twitter. The show on Twitter is at Marketplace. Up on Wall Street today, as I said, thanks very much, Fed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Sometimes you get lucky and the actual news lines up with what you've got planned for the news to be. With the big primaries last night in the rearview mirror, today is one of those days. Trade has been the big economic issue this time around, capital T, B, I, and E there. Thanks largely to Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, who regularly blast trade in general and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the big pending trade deal, in particular, every chance they get. Trade-friendlier candidates Hillary Clinton and John Kasich notably won in Ohio yesterday, but this primary season has at times felt like a referendum on free trade policies. That makes us really glad that we included a section on trade in the latest version of the Marketplace Edison Research poll, which is out this week. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson is our trade guru. She is here to walk us through the trade data. Tracy, first of all, what is, the biggest thing that jumped out at you?
Well, to start, almost half of people said they actually didn't know enough to say whether free trade agreements are good or bad for the U.S. economy. And that's, you know, that's a lot.
Yeah, it is. What about the ones who said they did know about free trade?
Okay, so of the people who did answer, 2/3 said they think free trade agreements are good for the U.S. economy. But honestly, when I started calling people back after the poll to see why they'd answered how they'd answered, you know, there was this wide range of understanding about how trade and trade agreements work. Lots of people maybe should have been in that first category of not understanding.
Yeah. Give me a for instance.
So, you know, obviously we don't want to put too much stock in any one answer, which is why we poll so many people. But I was hearing stuff like, you know, one guy wanted to go back to a system where we produce everything we consume, and he thought that would make stuff cheaper. Another person said he didn't see how trade even affected him or anyone in the middle class. He didn't think he'd bought anything made in another country.
Which just isn't the way global economies work, right?
Right. I mean, his TV, his cell phone, his clothes, all probably made in other countries. And that brings us to some other of the poll results. People were more likely to disagree than agree with the statement that free trade helps their own personal financial situation. And that kind of speaks to how hard it can be for people to feel or recognize the benefits of trade. I ran that by Susan Ariel Aronson. She's a professor at George Washington's Elliott School of International Affairs. And she said, trade is complex, and we tend to oversimplify it.
Policymakers tend to talk about trade in mercantilist terms. And so exports good, imports bad, right? But the truth is you can't produce anything in the United States without some imports.
You know, we don't tend to look at our stuff and say, thanks, trade. But when someone loses a job in an industry where imports are increasing, that is just much more visible. So you can think of trade theory as having two parts, says Howard Rosen. He's the executive director of the Trade Adjustment Assistance Coalition. The first is opening borders, usually lowering tariffs on foreign goods, often with a trade agreement. And that creates more competition, which typically lowers prices. And in econo-speak, it can free up resources, says Rosen.
Now, that's a nice way of saying that there's unemployment, people moving out of redundant industries, but we are also opening up foreign markets to U.S. producers. So you would expect to see a shift of those redundant resources into the expanding parts of the economy. And that is the problem in the United States.
That movement of workers from shrinking industries into expanding ones, Rosen says that's where the theory breaks down in practice. Gordon Hansen is an economist at UC San Diego. He's long studied how trade impacts labor markets.
The first thing we learned was, hey, when you want to talk about labor mobility, it's one thing to talk about software programmers who kind of move seamlessly between Austin and Silicon Valley and Boston and wherever. It's quite another thing to talk about workers with a high school education or less who started off in a factory job.
Hansen says a lot of that has to do with the regional nature of economies in the U.S. If you're a furniture maker in Raleigh-Durham, for example, and you lost your job, it may be really tough for you to find a new one in your area. Hansen looked at the impact of increasing Chinese imports on the U.S. labor force and found the adjustment period for workers was just a lot bigger than economists had assumed.
You get persistently higher unemployment rates and persistently higher rates of non-participation in the labor force for a full decade after the shock has hit.
A full decade after this surge of Chinese imports. And this is where you might say, yeah, close those borders. And that is exactly what we shouldn't do, says Hansen. He says we need to look inward to better support workers who lose their jobs, to help them retrain or relocate or create incentives for other firms to hire them. He says the support we do offer is just not good enough.
All right, Tracy, thanks. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson there on the trade desk for us. I don't know, maybe we should get one of those. Her reporting was driven by the results of the Marketplace Edison Research poll, as I said, the full results of which you can dig into on our website. And while you're there, take a second, do our quiz, see where you fall on the economic anxiety curve. It'll make sense when you get there. It's marketplace.org. Coming up.
This is the closest thing to a basic income that's existed for any significant period of time anywhere in the world.
Getting paid just for living somewhere. It's nice, but it's cold. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 74 points today, 0.4% after that Fed decision, finished at 17,325. Did the blue chips. The NASDAQ climbed 35 points, about 0.75%. 4763. The S&P 500 added 11.5%, 2027. Peabody Energy, or maybe Peabody, I don't know. The nation's biggest coal producer, down 45% on its way toward possible bankruptcy for the year. Peabody down 98%. Oil is hurting too, so maybe it's solar time. Solar City off 2%, down 58% in the last year. Sunrun up 5% today, down 55% since December. Double nickel. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.91%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Want to get social with Marketplace? Connect with our hosts, reporters, and producers online. Tell us what you think about our stories or suggest your own. Follow us on Twitter at Marketplace and like Marketplace APM on Facebook or Instagram.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Residents of the great state of Alaska have another couple of weeks to get their paperwork in. Permanent fund dividend applications are due by the end of the month. Those are the checks paid to every man, woman, and child in that state, funded in part by oil revenues. But you live by oil, you get clobbered by oil. Alaska's facing a big budget deficit brought on in part by falling oil prices. And lawmakers trying to close that gap are looking real hard at cutting the dividend, even as other countries are thinking about starting their own. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Waldholtz has the story.
Outside Alaska, the permanent fund dividend has probably been best summed up in the popular imagination by The Simpsons.
Welcome to Alaska. Here's $1,000.
Well, it's about time. But why?
And, okay, even to Alaskans, the dividend, known as the PFD, can sometimes seem a little nuts, especially when it tops $2,000, as it did last year. That's more than $8,000 for a family of four. But to the late Governor Jay Hammond, who pushed for the dividend in the early days of Alaska's oil boom, it just made sense. If the oil is owned by all Alaskans, he said, some of the benefits should go directly to the people. The result has been a 3.5-decade experiment, one that's drawn attention outside the state's borders.
This is the closest thing to a basic income that's existed for any significant period of time anywhere in the world.
Carl Weiderquist is a professor at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service in Qatar and a supporter of a universal basic income, which is pretty much what it sounds like, a guaranteed minimum payment for all citizens.
There are a lot of people talking about it, but only Alaska has done it, and Alaska's been doing it for over 30 years.
The idea is having a renaissance, spurred in part by growing attention to income inequality. There is a referendum planned for Switzerland, pilot projects rolling out in Finland, the Netherlands, and Canada, and interest from Silicon Valley. Weiderquist says all of these places can learn from Alaska. So what do we know after 34 years?
There's an awful lot that we don't know.
Gunnar Knapp runs the Institute of Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. There's not much research on the dividend, but some things are clear. For one, it's really popular. For another, the dividend matters a lot more if you're poor than if you're rich. For the 20% of Alaska households averaging $35,000 a year or less, the PFD is a major source of income. And Knapp says that's one reason Alaska has one of the most equal, or least unequal, distributions of wealth in the U.S.
There's many other things that enter into income equality, but certainly we know that the dividend is a contributing factor.
It also makes a bigger difference for Alaskans in rural areas than for those in urban hubs like Anchorage and Fairbanks. Standing outside the AC supermarket in Bethel, 400 miles from Anchorage, you meet plenty of people like Marie Andrew. She says her PFD usually goes to groceries and bills. If lawmakers cut the dividend, that will be a big deal.
It'll affect me a lot. I wouldn't be able to pay my lights or buy food.
Andrew is from Tuluksak, one of about 50 Alaska Native villages in the region, accessible mostly by small plane. There aren't a lot of jobs in this part of the state, and even the basics are expensive. At this grocery store, milk hovers around $7.50 a gallon. The PFD can be an essential cash infusion. It's also a way to build savings. 36-year-old Damian Jones, in town from Anchorage, says his dividend goes straight to the bank.
That's the best way to save it. You know, just put it in savings, let it accumulate, and when a rough time comes, you use it.
This is really an extremely important part of the PFD.
That's Gunnar Knapp again.
It provides a way to accumulate and save money over time. wealth that can pay for going to college, wealth that can pay for a down payment on a home, that can pay for starting a business.
And that may be the main takeaway from the Alaska experiment. Over the years, $1,000 here and a couple thousand there can really add up. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Waldholtz for Marketplace.
We've been doing a lot of coverage the past year or so of how television is changing from the way we watch it to the content of it. Some of those changes are happening at USA Network, a channel known mostly for reruns and scripted comedies, but also, as of last year, for Mr. Robot, the buzzy, buzzy drama about hacking and cybersecurity. So it's perhaps no surprise that earlier this year, the network followed up with a show called Colony. It's set in the near but very unpleasant future in Los Angeles. Aliens are involved somehow, an authoritarian government. It's all not very nice. The show is the brainchild of Carlton Cuse from most notably Lost, also Ryan Condal. They're both here. Gentlemen, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
I would like to know, and I guess I'll start, Carlton, with you, is I would like to know what the show is. Is it science fiction? Is it an alien thing? Is it a espionage thing? Is it a – because it's dark and dystopian for sure.
All of the above, Kai, plus a family drama.
And, well, yeah, I guess it is kind
of. And a love story. So it's
– I don't know about the love. I mean, yes, okay, but –
That's a long-term love
story.
All
right.
I think Ryan and I really love kind of cross-genre storytelling, and we'd like to think of this as sort of an espionage thriller with science fiction elements, or as someone called it, spy-fi.
Oh, I like that. That's good. That's good. I like that. So you guys came up with this idea, and you what? Went to USA Network and said, "Here's our pitch."
Well, actually, we went to.
No, okay. Clearly, no. All right. No. Is that not how Hollywood works?
No, you don't. You don't. Man. It's very hard to go in and say, "Hey, we want to do an alien invasion show," but there's no aliens, no invasion.
Well, yeah, right. Yeah,
but otherwise, it's awesome.
Yeah,
we presented our idea to Legendary, which is a company basically best known for big movies.
Yeah.
They've been involved in like the Batman movies and Godzilla, things like that. And they were getting into television. And they basically paid us to write a script. And then we shopped that script around. And we sent the script around. And we had a bunch of different places that were interested in it. But the company that was most interested was USA. And USA seemed very clearly interested in changing their brand and evolving from the types of shows that they were doing. And they expressed kind of wholesale enthusiasm for the project. You know, you always have that issue where some people are like, well, we like it, but we want to change part of your apple to an orange, you know. and USA like fully bought into our take on it. And so – and we felt like it would be a great place to go and be a part of their evolution.
And this comes on the heels of USA with Mr. Robot, which has done well, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the really – Mr. Robot was sort of the first show that marked their evolution, and Colony is really the second one.
What happens then as you guys get going? You're in production. Episode one airs. It gets some traction. What does the network say to you? Do they say, good job, keep on going? Or do they say, listen, about this scene, we thought maybe it would have been better if?
You know, I have to give credit to both of our studio partners in Legendary and then Universal Cable Productions, which is the home NBC Universal studio, and USA. They've really been very hands-off. I mean, really the show that you're watching, that everybody's watching, is really the show that Carlton and I wanted to make. And we've really been really blessed, I think, to have a great, strong creative say over everything that goes on the air.
Hmm. Carlton, this is not your first rodeo. I mean, you were involved with Lost. You go back to Nash Bridges. I mean, you've been – this is going to sound terrible. You've been around for a while, right?
Yeah.
How has it changed? How has show running changed in the 20, 30 years you've been doing this?
I think the biggest change is we've moved away from kind of, I think, a lowest common denominator mentality. When I first started, there were four networks, and there really wasn't a lot of cable production. And the goal of networks were to put on shows that reach the broadest possible audience. Now I think we live in an environment where there are 410 scripted television shows between network, cable, and streaming services. The most important thing is kind of the level of engagement. You don't need to be everybody's favorite show, but you need to be somebody's favorite show.
Do you guys worry, Ryan, about ratings?
I mean, sure, you know, it's ratings are still.
But the big picture, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, as Carlton said it really well, we're very happy if we have some level of fan engagement. And we have a really strong core audience, which is, as the co-creator of the show, probably, you know, patting myself on the back, but like,
that's
I'm
right.
very
we'll
impressed that we've been able to do this. I mean, the show is not based on anything. It's a completely original idea created entirely for television. I mean, we have two tremendous stars at the top of the show. We have, you know, Carlton and his relationship with Josh and them and the history
Josh
of
Holloway,
Lost.
The guy from Lost, who you worked with, right?
Yes. Yeah. And Sarah Wayne Kelly's from The Walking Dead.
Right. Yeah. But to be able to get an audience that, without having a Marvel comic book or a remake of a 90s TV show or an extension of a movie, I mean, in this climate is really impressive, I think.
Episode 3-ish or so airs, and then you guys get picked up for a second season. What was that phone call like?
I was on a plane. Yeah. So I was flying to New Jersey, and I had bought the in-flight Wi-Fi, and we had sort
paid a zillion dollars for the in-flight Wi-Fi.
Yeah, but it was money well spent. I opened my email, and I have like 30 emails waiting for me, which is just – I had just gotten on the plane an hour ago. So you know, either something good or bad had happened. Right. So it was kind of the shocking thing, and I landed, and I had 10 voicemails waiting for me. It was really nice. I mean, we sort of knew that it was coming, but to get the official pickup was really exciting.
Yeah, you see, you have those moments, and it's when you end up – if you get a lot of voicemails or emails, you know it's good news, because good news always finds you, and in Hollywood, bad news avoids you like the plague. Like,
oh,
if you
right?
get – yes, if you have no calls and no emails, you're not going to have good news.
Hollywood sounds terrible, man, I got to say. I'm just – maybe that's just me. I don't know.
It's good except when it's bad.
Carlton Cuse and Ryan Condal from Colony. Thanks very much for coming in, you guys.
Thanks.
Thank you. Season finale, by the way, airs tomorrow night, USA Networks. This final note on the way out today, and I know I say this a lot, but this time I really seriously mean it. It is this week's sign the apocalypse is upon us. Starbucks is out with a new springtime beverage, a cherry blossom frappuccino, which is bad enough in and of itself. Here's the kicker. No cherries at all in the thing. It's got strawberries. Wrong on so many levels. All right, we got to go. Janet Yellen spoke. The markets rose. That's all you need to know. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. Engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you again tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.